You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Kat Rosenfield.
And I'm Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, and we are Feminine Chaos.
Here today with Lee Stein, the author of new novel, Self Care. It comes out on, I think, June 30th. Is that correct? Yep. And also the recent author of an extremely viral Medium essay called The End of the Girl Boss is Here. Needless to say, all of these are topics very relevant to our, Phoebe's and my, interests and the Feminine Chaos audience's interests. So Lee, welcome. And why don't you tell us a little bit more about your book and your background?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. As Kat mentioned, my book is called Self Care. It comes out June 30th, and it is a satire of the wellness industry and girl boss feminism. So for 3 years, I ran a feminist nonprofit organization called Out of the Binders, which was a joke on Mitt Romney's gaffe that he had binders full of us, so we were out of the binders. And I ran a conference called BinderCon for women writers. And I totally burned out on this feminist organizing experience. And that's what led me to start writing this novel. So I'm really interested in internet culture and internet drama and women using feminism as part of their brand. And so that's what led me to write this book. And the book is about two women who start a company called Ritual, R-I-C-H-U-A-L. That's kind of like if Goop and Instagram had a baby. It's like a social network. But drama ensues, and the two women at the helm of the company are forced to ask themselves, you know, should we be good people or should we try to make some money?
It's so good, and it just anticipates this moment. It's so funny and timeless in that regard, but it also just, it's like, it's playing, this is playing out now. I mean, if Ritual were real, I would be completely reading it constantly because I would. But it's just all of these like apology statements from, the sort of the Devons and the Marins of the world are just, they keep coming and it's like, ah, It's there. It's funny rereading it, your novel now, because it's like, it's happening. It's on.
I got really lucky with the timing, I think, like with everything happening with The Wing and Man Repeller and Refinery 29, all these women held media companies that have kind of used social justice as branding are being held to account now.
Yeah. Yeah. So Lee, are you actually a time traveler from the future? It's very important, you know, to know. Did you go forward and then come back to write about everything that was going to happen? Or do you just have your finger so thoroughly on the pulse of all of this stuff that you were able to see the writing on the wall before it all unfolded?
That's funny. Like, the book is set in February 2017. So I set the book 1 month after Trump was inaugurated, and I picked a very defined time window because I thought, like, I don't know what's going to happen with this guy. Like, I don't know what's going to happen to our country. So I'm just going to pick a few week time period. But even then, there was so much drama around the Women's March. And what I've been thinking a lot about lately is, like, when I was running this Facebook group, which had 40,000 members, I would, like, go into the trenches of this Facebook group every day, and then I would emerge, and then I would tell my partner what had happened on the internet that day. But what I'm finding today is that it's not happening in these tiny bubbles. It's actually happening in this, like, grander sphere of public discourse that everyone, including, like, my 71-year-old mom, like, she's aware of these online controversies. So the bubble has expanded. So I thought I was writing about kind of a subculture or a smaller internet community, but I think we're all living it now at large.
Yeah, I think that's really, really true. I mean, I think a lot of us who have been kind of interested in these topics, we were told for so long, like, oh, this is niche. This is only, you know, for the people who are online. And then I think partly also, with the pandemic and, you know, everyone being at home, everyone who can be online is that much more online. And there's like dividing things between online life and real life starts to seem
Internet is more real at this point. Like, at least, you know, we can all see each other's faces instead of wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. Right. Is this real? Is this more real life than when we go out in public wearing masks?
It might be at this point. You get home, you take your mask off and you log on, and then you also take your like mask off. You stop you stop being polite and start getting real. As
right. Absolutely. Oh boy.
Right.
So we wanted to talk about, I mean, basically like your entire book, which just, you know, inject it directly into my veins. It's so
exactly.
good. And
off, there were some lines. Okay. You should, oh, I'm sorry, but just the thing about, okay, sorry. Can I just say a very intense post by Maren Gelb sponsored by Lunar Milk. That got me. That really got me. And then, sorry, I just need to like explain the, okay, this line, there were layers of offense to unearth here and everyone was on an archaeological dig. Oh my God, that's the internet. That's what's happening. That's so beautiful. Sorry.
I think I learned that from a Freddie DeBoer piece about offense archaeology or something.
Oh yeah, Planet of Cops, which we mention on our podcast all the time.
Yes.
Yeah, but it does seem like digging through the layers, you know, maybe you don't know why it's offensive at first, but if you keep looking, you'll find reasons.
Yes, you'll find something. Yeah, there's that opportunism aspect of it. I want to return to talking about self-care, in a little bit, but also want to talk about your extremely viral Medium essay about the fall of the girl boss, which you somehow managed to basically predict, three years before it happened. And so there was, I'm just going to grab a quote here. So you were talking about lean-in feminism, which Phoebe also wrote a piece about the death of recently. And this one sentence really kind of got to it for me. It was, Sandberg allowed women to feel like they were activists whenever they advocated for themselves. And I have been thinking a lot about this and how it basically, for a very, very brief time period, it leveraged this sense that the sense of anxiety and insecurity that a lot of young millennial women suffer from, into self-advocacy, where suddenly like you yourself were the good cause and to lean in was to push against sexism. So you were doing something noble, by advocating for yourself. Why didn't that last? What changed?
Oh, did it change? This idea of like self-empowerment feminism, I think it anger can be so activating. It can feel so good to be angry and to have an object to be angry at. And when I was writing the book, you know, writing that book in 2017 on the heels of the Women's March, just the anger at Donald Trump being our president, but feeling powerless to do anything. So you look for other targets. Mm-hmm. And so if whatever you can do, I don't know, there's it's self-empowerment, but it's also like you feel part of a community with other women who feel the same way you do. And I think that's a really powerful feeling too. So yeah. You feel like an activist when you're speaking up for women. And then you can also justify things to yourself, like, well, I'm doing this because of inequality, so that gives me permission to do X thing.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting just in terms of the whole, in terms of self-care in the very literal sense of, like, putting on a face cream and so forth, how it seems like there's been this real sort of reclaiming of all of that, of, like, having a skincare routine and stuff as not just okay by feminist standards, but like the ultimate feminist act is like doing something coded as feminine that's been denigrated by society and all of this. And I'm really struck by, sorry to keep returning to your novel, but how Devin, her internal monologue is, it's an Into the Gloss top shelf. Like, it's just, but I mean, a satire of it was just amazing. And it really, this notion that the more, like all of the, Kat and I were talking about this recently in terms of Sephora having, this was in the, when there were still stores, having ads that sort of make you think you're doing something noble and sort of gender challenging by buying makeup. There just seems to be some way that this it's not just that like anything you do for yourself is activism, but it's also anything you do that's gendered feminine sort of is somehow anything you used to feel like a bad feminist for doing is suddenly now good.
Right. So I think there's like a lot of guilt and shame because we were told by the beauty industry, we were told one thing, like when I was growing up reading whatever I was reading, 17 magazine or the messages I got about beauty and skincare and diet and losing weight. And that has all changed. But if we want to groom ourselves, I think the brands are aware that we also want to feel like we're activists at the same time. So like I'm getting Instagram ads for a lip gloss that donates 10% to like an LGBTQIA organization so that I can feel like I'm supporting gay people whenever I use this lip gloss. So it's getting very complicated.
Yeah.
But I think it is to assuage our guilt that we, and it's so complicated. Am I buying into the patriarchy by putting on makeup to come on this podcast? I mean, I'm very confused. I'm very confused as a woman. And from that place of confusion, I wrote this book.
It's so funny. I'm sorry. So good.
Yeah. Well, now it's interesting because you're talking about, we've segued from sort of, encouraging women to like literally look into the mirror. It's, and do your skincare routine. And it's an act of, of radical feminism and radical activism to spend 10 minutes literally staring at yourself, putting stuff on your face. But now the notion of self-improvement or self-care is kind of pivoted to, working on mostly at this point, your racism. So we're back to, look into the mirror, like spend all of this time interrogating yourself. But it's less about looking at what's on the surface and more about kind of like aiming your gaze right into your own navel and maybe never relieving it, never getting it out.
Yeah, like to circle back to Lean In was a lot of that book is like, what are your own personality defects? Are you too much of a people pleaser? Have you been conditioned to do that by the patriarchy? How can you stop doing that? So it was like work on your personality. Then we get, like Glossier. So the beauty trend that it's no longer about wearing a lot of makeup. It's about having perfect skin and then lightly putting makeup on top of your perfect skin. So like then we had to master that. And now we have, I was working on this op-ed, but it didn't find a home, so I'll just tell the joke here. But like I had a joke in this op-ed, like it's like the life-changing magic of tidying up your whiteness.
So
it's
my God.
Another.
It needs a home. I wanted to have a home.
It's like another self-improvement trend. You worked on your home, you worked on your skincare, you worked on your personality. Now you need to work on your implicit bias because you're secretly much more racist than you ever dreamed you were.
Oh, I'm so glad you gals have put this together. Cause like I wrote about this years ago in terms of like privilege awareness and all of that, but I never had thought about it in terms of like fitting in with other types of self-improvement, but it totally, only in terms of like college admissions where you're sort of like promoting yourself in a very specific way, but what's also interesting about it is like it's a way of sort of addressing like this binary, either women as women are the most oppressed people in the world or white privileged women in the West / in the States are the most privileged in the world and the true oppressors. This is a kind of way of, I don't know if it's bridging the gap or if it's just kind of switching things back to women as victims, but turning it like this, the whole self-improvement, self-flagellation thing that's currently underway on all of these platforms is just like, I wonder, is anybody really going to like, is this a case where women are like women CEOs are self-sabotaging in a way that male CEOs wouldn't, or is this just part of their branding and they'll be just fine? That's, I guess, some of this time will tell, but
I mean, that's a good question, right? Is it fair for us to hold women to a different standard than what we hold men to? Is it fair that we have to say women have to be perfect, impeccable feminists while they succeed, and men are just men?
Right. I mean, and there's like this is an interesting segue, because this additional burden, right, that women are, I mean, I think kind of undeniably subjected to, was this expectation that you are going to work against your own interests if it's in service of, like, the cause that we've decided is the most important thing. And I feel like we've seen this a lot lately on a small scale, where you have individual writers who are getting, like, chastised for accepting assignments, doing certain work because they're taking up space that should have gone to someone else. And, like,
the New Yorker swimsuit with headscarf.
Oh,
and I forgot about that.
Right. Yeah. There was the Rihanna Vogue interview, which, I mean, these are things that we discussed in previous episodes. But also even more recently, like Maris Kreisman wrote a good piece for the LA Times about how you could improve diversity in publishing by paying your entry-level employees a living wage, which, you know, another thing that we've discussed here, like, yes, you know, Feminine Chaos endorses this as, you know, not the only, but maybe one tine of a possible solution. So, you know, Maris Kreisman wrote this piece for the LA Times and immediately got, like, excoriated for, you know, for writing it when she should have apparently passed the assignment along to a more deserving writer, you know, a writer of color. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that the thing about this, and it kind of drives me crazy to see it because, I mean, most of the women who are doing this, they're just freelancers. You know, it's not like they have institutional support. They all already suffer from crazy imposter syndrome anyway. So, you know, it's incredibly effective to take this approach. You know, say you're taking up space, like, get out of here. And so instead of lean in, it's bench yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. This whole, the taking up space thing is so fascinating because, and I guess this does get the whole sort of girl boss lean in backlash thing again, because it really, like, the whole thing had been, you're entitled to take up space as a woman. Don't apologize. You know, that is feminism. That's noble and beautiful and all of that. And now it's like, but don't take up space if you are a woman who's privileged in whichever way. I recently, on a forum I take part in, but only as a lurker on Facebook, a different forum, but saw a whole sort of meltdown thing that could totally have been satire, but sort of tragically wasn't. And the woman being piled on was a non-Black person of color, and it just, but she was privileged within a very specific context, like very highly specific context. And it's like, she's the privileged party, and therefore, you know, that's that, you know, and it sparked another post as a whole thing. Yeah, it just basically any woman who can be considered privileged in any sort of specific context is suddenly the oppressor and shouldn't be taking up space. And then I guess it's just, it's very confusing what's supposed to be done, I guess, like what's actually helpful and what's just kind of ceding the ground to the same men who were in power already.
Right. And I think, like, my book is set on the internet now, which is where we all live now. But I think the internet has a way of really flattening our identities and also encouraging us to create these personal brands based on our identities.
Oh, my goodness. I'm obsessed with a line from your book about, okay, this is in a forum. Okay. What if every ritual user put their identity markers in their profile so we all wouldn't have to make assumptions from their pic? Like Black, capitalized, avant la lettre, okay, white, not capitalized, Jewish, Palestinian, cis, trans, NB, straight, bi, queer, vegan, gluten-free, Pisces, INFJ, I don't know this one, et cetera. What is INFJ?
You don't know. I'm an INFJ.
It's the Myers-Briggs thing.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Just as an aside, there is a whole sphere of Twitter where people do put that in their bios.
Yeah.
It's and it demarcates, so much in the way that pronouns in the bio, not so much anymore, but used to demarcate a certain type of online entity. The presence of your Myers-Briggs personality type also denotes a certain type of online entity. And because I don't want all of the ET F J's coming after me and burning my house down. I'm not going to say anything.
No, the F's are nice because the F's, I'm an F. It's about feelings. You want to make the other person feel okay when you're giving feedback.
Oh, right. It's the T's.
It's the T's you should be afraid of.
It's the TJ's.
The TJ's. That's right.
I will Google this later. I've heard of Myers-Briggs, but I've never heard of putting this in a bio. Wow. Just about the whole online world though, and the women, all of this, and I say this for obvious, personal reasons, obvious to Kat and to perhaps our listeners. So childcare basically disappeared, during this pandemic with no particular end in sight. School is kind of a questionable thing. And there's just something kind of weird that I'm trying to, I don't know if this is a very vague thought I have at the moment, but there's something kind of weird about the true death of empowerment, feminism, coinciding with a time when just for logistical reasons, mothers of young or even not so young children are basically being kicked out of the workforce.
Yes.
In droves. And I don't know. I don't know where that thought goes, but it's just something that I've seen both written about a lot and been, you know, living. It seems like there are pluses and minuses, I think, to the end of that sort of feminism. Like obviously Sheryl Sandberg, I do not identify on a personal level at all with Sheryl Sandberg. I wish I had that sort of drive or, you know, ability to think about money. But I guess what I'm asking is what's lost, maybe, if anything, or is it just good riddance to girl boss feminism? Is there anything, does it have anything in its favor? Like, will it be sad if it's gone?
I want to say something about you. I think it's so valid that you bring up this issue of childcare, because I think that was one of the original critiques of Lean In, is that it's fine and well to lean into your ambition and like, go girl, but like, who's watching your kids? Like Sheryl Sandberg has very good childcare. And so I think we are having a moment now where we're like, how long can this go on for people who do have children? And I think it's so easy to get into this offense archaeology on social media and avoid the bigger problems, because the bigger problems are so impossible to solve. How do we get Mitch McConnell out of running the country? I don't have a good idea, but like, he's a much bigger problem than like a bad word in a tweet.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a good point. The difference between, you know, what seems intractable. And I wrote about this sort of self-help brand of like feminist social justice, for Tablet, which is, the piece is not out, unfortunately, but
I was going to be like, I can't wait to go. Okay.
It's going to be on Tuesday. It's the 26th. This is too
Tuesday will be the 30th.
The 30th. Oh, also
my book will come out and Kat's piece will come out.
Right. Obviously one of these things is more important. which is Lee's book.
And also I think that the recycling may have to go out here, you know.
Oh.
I don't know.
Are you obliquely threatening to put Lee's book
in the- No.
I don't know. Not. That seemed like a microaggression.
Oh no, it was a self-deprecating remark about that I have nothing going on the 30th.
Oh.
Particularly.
Maybe you should reread Self-Care. Or, you know, or any one of these other tomes that are being recommended to us. And
I will memorize White Fragility so as to recite it.
One of the things that I kind of, you know, wanted to sort of think my way around in this piece is the idea that, you know, this self-help brand of social justice is so inherently disempowering. I mean, we have, you know, the women who kind of buy into this is very highly educated, elite, privileged, mostly white, but more importantly, just, you know, very successful women, who are like, if they organize, they're one of the most powerful voting blocks out there. I mean, there's a reason why everyone wants to speak to, like, I mean, I guess back in 2008 or whatever, it was soccer moms, but it's always that same group who's sort of sought after, because they do actually hold enormous power if they leave their homes and coalesce and act, you know, do activism like
as a block.
Well, this was, I don't remember if you guys talked about the Jen Mag piece about Karens, but she makes this point. I can't remember the writer's name, but she talks about how we flipped the house in 2018 because of suburban white women voters.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And these books are like, no, you don't get to do activism. You have to work on yourself. Go inside, sit on your hands, unpack your shit, like work and work and work on yourself for how, forever, you know, probably forever. Oh,
I literally saw a tweet that was somebody saying that anti-racism shouldn't be something accessible to somebody who's a soccer mom, like literally said soccer mom trying to do it in her spare time. And it's like,
you should do it full time.
Well, it just seemed like it needs to be more difficult than that. It's no joke. It's no laughing matter.
Yeah.
And it's like, so basically, if you aren't a 19-year-old college student, you can't be anti-racist, because if you have other obligations, well, then you're just racist for having right. them.
And what's so insane is that, like, I mean, you know, for most of us who, like, aren't 19-year-old college students, oh, if only. Mm-hmm. Those were such good skin days. But, you know, you do have a job and a family and adult obligations, and, you know, political engagement is inherently something that is probably not your full-time job. But that makes it all the more important to, you know, do it in the spare minutes, even if it's like, and I mean, this is the thing that drives me crazy about this kind of breed of you know, act. It's like slacktivism, basically. It's, you know, it keeps you passively turning pages and thinking about yourself instead of, you know, doing anything that could change the world.
Is it like a neoliberal thing of like, that's actually the whole point of this, and that the whole point of it is to kind of maintain the status quo? And I mean, that had been my thinking in terms of like privilege awareness, that the whole point of privilege awareness is that it refocuses energies on, not always intentionally, but on awareness rather than on doing anything about it. So like the end goal of privilege awareness is being aware of your privilege and being polite about it and having the right etiquette. But if anything that, right. Yeah. And if anything, that may just reinforce whichever, hierarchies, and there's no implication that you're actually even interested in changing things. You may want to maintain your privilege, but you just are being nicer about it or something. So I almost wonder if that's the same dynamic with the like activism as self-improvement, that if you're home reading, you know, 40 books about, you know, like the reading list that keeps growing about, how to be woke today, yeah, you're probably not doing anything else. And I wonder, like, whether there are sort of forces at work encouraging that for that reason, if that makes sense.
This is indicative of the bubble that I live in, but I wouldn't say that the women I know reading White Fragility are not already activists, because I do know a lot of activists from my own organizing work with BinderCon. But what I am noticing in my bubble is that the women I know reading White Fragility are women with master's degrees. They have very far left politics. They are explicitly anti-racist. These would be, you know, the women that I would count as the most openly intersectional feminist anti-racist activists, and they're the ones reading White Fragility. So I'm not seeing this book like changing hearts and minds. I'm seeing white women who already feel bad that they're white reading this book. And an interesting critique that I've heard of White Fragility is that it's a distraction from the conversation about class, that we aren't really talking about class and capitalism when we're talking about and this surge of anti-racism. It's a way for these, you know, capitalism to continue and have us all fight about microaggressions, while Nike still makes a bajillion million dollars.
That makes sense, and kind of goes back to even like the dawn of this approach. Like I'm thinking of the Peggy McIntosh, privilege checklist, where so many of the things that she mentions as being her privileges as a white person are her privileges as a privileged white person, and how so much of what people discuss as white privilege is the privilege of white and wealthy people, or, you know, white and well-educated people. And it just, these things all matter, but yeah, to just try to find only one thing that's the thing that really matters, yeah, obviously ends up erasing quite a bit that's going on.
Right. McIntosh herself was like a one percenter, right? She came from an extremely wealthy family.
I think I learned that in Quillette, but yeah. What I had known is that she had taught at a very posh private school, in Manhattan. which seemed just like a fascinating origin point for all of this.
Yeah, I think that she also came from family wealth. It's phenomenal to imagine somebody writing that essay and never pausing to think about class, you know, the invisible knapsack essay.
I mean, you know, I guess I wonder how much is intentional. I wonder how much is...
Unpacking the invisible Dior knapsack. You know?
Well, this is something that actually has come up in Canada, where I am. I'm not Canadian, but I do live in Canada. A friend of mine has tweeted about this and frequently reminds everybody about it because it's amazing. Justin Trudeau, our prime minister, very good looking, son of another prime minister, has apologized for his, I guess, like his white privilege, his white male privilege, I don't know, which I'm sure he has. He also has son of a prime minister privilege, which you would think would be maybe the more salient thing in his own case. And I almost wonder if in cases like this, this is somebody, when certain people mention their white privilege, it's a way of sort of distracting from the privilege that they have an even more obvious
sort of their economic privilege.
Economic and cultural. Yeah. I mean, like his connections as the son of a prime minister would be different from, you know, those of like a random white Canadian who would have certain privileges in society in terms of certainly interactions with law enforcement, among other issues, but would not have his connections and so forth.
I think that's a good point. I have no argument with this.
Well, I can make a connection to my novel because, like, there's three main characters of my novel, Marin and Devin, who are the white co-founders, and Khadija, who's, like, their star number one employee. Khadija is a Black woman. She is frequently put in charge of things like listicles for Black History Month, pose for this photograph so that everyone knows we have a diverse company. But I think all three of my characters all harbor resentments and all think that the other ones have it better than them. And I think this kind of jockeying is reinforced and encouraged by the internet, where you're constantly comparing yourself to other people and trying to calculate how much advantage or how much disadvantage do other people have, and react accordingly. And it's not a healthy way to engage with other people, in my opinion.
No, and it's something the internet really, because of its way of flattening, you know, who everybody is, encourages it both where you don't know who people are online and the whole, all you have are just a few details. And it's much, like, I just can't imagine in real life, in offline life, interacting with somebody via each identity marker, you know, in that way. Mm. But online, it's almost like you're a bad person if you don't do that. Like, do you not, like, wait, there was some story about this recently, and I'm forgetting what it was, but where you're a bad, was it some advice column or something? Where it was like you're a bad person.
Oh, was this the Slate one where the woman wrote in saying,
yes,
you know, my kids have a diverse group of friends.
Right.
They say that they don't care about race, and I think this letter was probably trolling because she was like, as I understand it, not caring about race is as bad as being actively racist or almost. And the advice columnist was like, well, you're trolling me, but actually it is, you know, go do some reading. But yeah.
Off the whole go do some reading thing. There is, I'm still obsessed with some article we talked about on the podcast a while back about the anti-racist reading list and just the notion that at this particular time, people have the time to even read quite that much is its own question.
Or the focus.
I'm worried about, I'm worried about everyone getting so self-conscious that we just go back to living in a segregated society. And I know some places still are segregated. I understand that. But you know, where I would be so afraid of screwing up that I wouldn't have Black friends and that I would just only hang out with other white people because I have to be of my kind. Yesterday I just listened to the Block and Reported podcast episode.
I was just about to mention this.
Who went through a year of white fragility anti-racism training, and she talked about how part of the training was separating into what was called white affinity groups. So the people of color had their group, and then the white affinity group could work on their racism with other white people without putting the burden on people of color, which I understand conceptually, but I don't.
Just like, let's get a bunch of white people together in a room and encourage them to strongly identify as white while we treat them like a persecuted minority. What could possibly come wrong?
Is it Connor Friedersdorf who's, I think, written about, like, that's, you know, the sort of, you, it's like the horseshoe theory thing, you know, like, is it good for white people to
reinforce their white identity?
Well, I guess, is it good, but I would even like push further and say, like, is it good, but also does it naturally follow that if you put a bunch of white people together and have them think about whiteness, that they will then naturally want to shed the advantages of whiteness, or will they become that much more attached to them? And I think that comes up with all forms of privilege, that, you know, making people aware, even more aware of the significance of all of their advantages that they didn't earn, it doesn't naturally follow that somebody wouldn't want their unearned advantages. And especially once you start talking about people who are not, again, 19-year-old, sorry to beat up on 19-year-old college students. It's just, yeah, it is the skin jealousy. It's the skin jealousy here as well. But yeah, it's just, you know, life is difficult and everybody has idiosyncratic setbacks in their life. And I think people do kind of cling to, when they're not, you know, thinking in the abstract, people do cling to their unearned advantages. And yeah, I just don't think this notion that becoming aware that you've had an easier time of it in one way, I don't think it's implied in that you would feel so bad about it that you would do anything more than performatively, I guess, reject it.
Yeah, well, I think that insofar as this stuff has been studied at all, what they found was that kind of hammering on white privilege, it didn't lead people to improve their attitudes towards people of color, but it did make them much, much, much less sympathetic towards white people who live in poverty. That was like the most measurable impact of that approach.
That makes sense intuitively, and also yeah, fits with the whole way that white privilege gets used to refer to privileges not shared by all white people, but rather shared by the wealthiest.
Yeah,
right.
Lee, you were talking about the Blocked and Reported interview with this woman who went through the race training, and you know, we got a little bit derailed, but you were talking about that because it did have an impact on her, right?
Oh, I think I just brought it up because I was just thinking of that white affinity. I was just thinking of this idea of segregation, of whether we should all be separate.
Right. I mean, it made her incredibly anxious about her friendships with, you know, her black coworkers, and she found herself shying away from interactions with them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was exhausting and terrifying having to interrogate herself after every single one to be like, wait, but was I racist?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead,
Phoebe.
Oh no. I was just going to say that this seems to be, like, in the writing world in general, something that many writers of color will, and journals of color will object to, and rightly so, that they will then be sort of brought on solely to sort of explain diversity. And even if they're paid for their work, even if it isn't some sort of unpaid labor of, you know, educating people, you know, just because you have experience of being black doesn't mean that's the only thing you would know about. It doesn't make any sense. And then, you know, writers get pigeonholed and are only allowed to write, you know, novels where diversity is specifically, or oppression specifically, at the center of it. So I think it's not just that this approach forces white people to walk on eggshells, but it also just kind of, it also leaves a space so that almost that white people are the only ones who can write about whatever.
Yeah. This is so important and segues into what I wanted to talk about, which is like one of the critiques of my Girl Boss piece has been like, easy to critique this, but like, what's the solution? Like, where do we go from here? And, you know, if I'm going to critique, you know, white fragility, self-improvement work, what's my answer? And I can just speak from my experience as a feminist organizer. When I had my conference, BinderCon, we were very strategic in how we did our panels and workshops, and we wanted to have diversity, but we also didn't want to just have the black writers talk on a panel about being black writers. So we did panels about sports writing and reproductive justice and writing as a mom, balancing work-life balance, that were diverse, where we didn't expect women to only talk about their identity. And the other example I wanted to give is that there's this nonprofit called VIDA that was counting bylines by gender in major publications. And in 2014, when I started my conference, Harper's Magazine was one of the worst in terms of gendered bylines. So they were publishing way more men than women. And so we thought, why is that? Is it because they aren't getting enough pitches by women? Or like, who knows? It's very hard to know why. But we put together an event at the conference called Speed Pitch where writers could sign up to pitch editors. And I went to Harper's Magazine and I said, these are your numbers. Will you send a female editor to your to our conference? Because it was a women-only conference. They didn't have any female editors they could send.
Oh, no.
So I said, like, who else can you send? And so they sent one of their top male editors to our conference. And I thought that was great. So he was the only man that came to our conference, but he was there to take pitches from women. So, like, looking for things that I can do myself, not just how I can reflect on my whiteness, but like thinking of things I can actually do in the professional space where I work, is how I don't self-flagellate all day long.
That's such a brilliant tactic too. And so what was the outcome of your bringing that guy in? Did a lot of people place pieces with him?
I don't know if anyone placed a piece with him, but just like, I don't, but then we had a range of different editors, but he was, and good on Harper's for sending him. I think, like, yeah, you know, that was a way for them to show that they were paying attention too.
So on the subject of binders, it did ultimately end up melting down a little bit. Yeah. Like there was, surrounding BinderCon, you know, I don't want to get too deeply into
this. Oh, we can get into it.
But the, you know, there was, and you mentioned this in, I think in your Gen piece, that there was a certain amount of drama, that resulted in you eventually deciding to step away, that it just got exhausting. And we've talked about this before, on another podcast episode about how women's spaces seem especially prone to unraveling in this particular way. Why do you think that is?
It's poignant to me. I recently became a member of the Freelance Community Study Hall where you have to pay to be a member. And so they pay moderators to moderate it. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we tried to do with binders and we could never figure out a way to monetize it. But we always thought it would be a healthier space if you had some financial stake in it, if you had to pay $5 a month for these resources so that we could compensate the moderators, because I was one of the moderators. It's exhausting work. It's every holiday weekend, everyone would be on Facebook and there would be a new conflict for me to be tagged into to moderate. So why is it women? I don't know, but I can say like the one of the final straws was a big conflict about whether we should have babies and children at the conference or not. Women were very divided on this, and I am a Libra. I'm an INFJ and a Libra, but I really listened and I really tried to find a compromise. I listened to both sides. I listened to arguments for babies. I listened to arguments against babies. The women on my staff who had children didn't want the babies. So it wasn't just, if you have a baby, you believe this or not. It was really complicated, and I think this is one of these sticky problems of contemporary feminism. I still to this day don't know what the right answer is. I don't know that I should have done anything differently, but it feels like I failed because I couldn't find the perfect feminist compromise.
Meanwhile, so, if there were a man at a conference holding a baby, that would go viral for look at the good father.
Look at the good father. You're right.
It would. But I think it's interesting that, I mean, this expectation that you, Lee Stein, were going to find the perfect feminist compromise, the perfect woman's compromise. Like, what is it about women that there's this expectation? And I mean, you see this not just, you know, when people are like battling about what the rules are going to be at a convention, but also in terms of what we expect, like influencers or brands
or knitting bloggers,
right, to do for us. You know, there's this expectation that women are going to always step in and always listen and always nurture everybody's, you know, hurt feelings, basically. And, you know, I just wonder, you know, is it just that like people want these brands to be their mom, basically, that like there's, you know, it's like,
like an expectation of caregiving.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, wow.
I am a former babysitter as well, so that's also part of my identity.
Ooh, I mean, I too used to sit babies.
I didn't. That's not a job I've ever had. I've tutored, but I've never babysat, and it was a shock to have a baby. And
so you're the only one of us who actually has her own baby.
Yeah, and I'm torn about whether she should. I mean, it all seems so irrelevant in this age of not being able to go anywhere, whether she could go with me to a
conference. But I'm remembering Lean In again, because in the Lean In chapter about negotiating for a raise, she says that you have a better chance if you make it about the team and the community, that what you've done for the group. So you aren't supposed to say like, I fucking do it all. I'm a badass. Like, give me that $10,000. It's like, I really worked with our team on this project, and we. So I think there's also an expectation of community, collaboration, togetherness, that maybe in male dominated spaces is more individual, but I don't know. I'm not in any male dominated spaces.
I wonder in terms of like, I'm thinking of Lena Dunham, who I see gets a mention in your novel, which is
a complicated relationship with Lena Dunham.
she's always somewhere, isn't she? But how, her whole making of her brand as being about kind of both being oblivious and being kind of enlightened and progressive and all of this, I think it's not always the case. It's not going to be the case with like in conservative women's spaces, but any left of center to highly progressive women's space is going to sort of present itself as on a sort of enlightened mission. And that's why it should be supported. It's feminist, all of this, which opens up that critique of, but is it intersectionally feminist?
And that's right.
Then is the wing an intersectionally feminist entity, cause it does, it's like, it couldn't just, like, there isn't just a sort of neutral women's, politically neutral idea of a women's space at this point. Everything just has like the seeds of infighting.
And it's all political. Yeah. There's no non-political all-female space that I can think of.
No.
And when they start out that way, like cupcakes and cashmere, the politics just creeps in.
I know there's like a private Slack channel for Glossier where they talk to customers. Like, I wonder if that's political.
Oh my goodness.
We got to find someone.
The boy brow. So, I like it. I like the boy brow. I forgot to use it for this, but it's good. I should try to Slack. Does that mean if you've bought Boybrow, do you get into Slack?
I think it's like an invite only. I heard Emily Weiss talk about it on a podcast, I think.
Ooh.
So she seems to be the only, okay, this is, now we're getting into really the nitty gritty of such things. She seems the only influencer from that kind of cohort to have emerged from this moment unscathed and still as beloved as ever.
Yeah, what does her Instagram look like? Is she posting Black Lives Matter memes?
I have. I come prepared for.
I'm so glad that somebody knew this.
I have done like, I'm behind in like all my email and stuff, but I know this. work-life balance has a way of doing strange things. She posted that must be Glossier, or I don't know if it's Into the Gloss, whatever, is donating $1 million to stuff. I don't remember exactly which aspects of stuff, but, and there was a post, like, all of these brands, but what was different about this than the Man Repeller cupcakes and cashmere style of post was there was no apology. It wasn't like, and it wasn't about herself. It was like their company, supports Black Lives Matter, And yeah, she's been less and less, I would say, the face. Emily Weiss has been less and less the face of the company. And they have, I think, they were already kind of doing things right before. So we talked
about Into the Gloss has women of color editors.
Yeah, it has women of color editors. It also beyond just, it sort of has this like, it's no longer just like, here's a French girl in her Parisian palace bathroom, but it'll also be like, here are nonprofit workers and their routines or things like that. So I think they kind of somehow I don't know. Maybe it's because it is really the self-care, the most self-care-ish of all of these seems to have been weirdly, yeah, like unscathed.
But I think you bring up a good example is that, like, I think what we're asking or what I'm asking for of these companies is, like, not only to use diverse models and their products to signal to customers that they're woke because they have a Black model and an Asian model, but to actually, like, in their staffing have diversity, that it isn't just led by white women. I think that's the problem is white women hiring other white women from the network. This is the Lena Dunham problem. She said, I don't have any friends that aren't white. Like, well, this is the book that I know.
It's absolutely the Lena Dunham problem. I think it's also just like specifically to do with these blogs, any blog that begins as, and I guess, ritual is kind of that, I guess, where it's like a blog that has a face, you know, a blog, but even if it's not a personal blog, once a blog has kind of a personality associated with it, it's not just the same HR type issues as can come up anywhere, but, you know, of course the staff look like and seem like the founder. It's because they all are kind of ghostwriting in a way for the founder. So I think maybe the answer is just once a company gets to a certain size, like say more than two or three people, it's a company. It's not just, a face.
A cult of personality.
I was just going to say that, you know, when do you stop being a cult of personality and start becoming a brand? And, you know, there's probably like a little fudgy area in there where those two Venn diagrams overlap and people don't know how to escape that zone. And that's when they get in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think women of color have a legitimate grievance that they aren't receiving venture capital money in the same way white women are. That, you know, there's a reason that we know about Gwyneth. Like, you know, Gwyneth is getting the funding. The Wing is getting the funding. Where are all these other women-led companies that we haven't heard of because they aren't getting the same level of funding and support?
That's a good point.
It is.
So we are nearing the end of our episode. Any last thoughts on self-care, on capitalist feminism, woke capitalism and wellness, or
what do you else? Do you guys think this is the end of the girl boss, or do you think the girl boss will make a comeback?
I think it's the end. I mean, I don't think it's the end of women being bosses, but I think that there's a whole moment of like the sort of that Glossier but not Glossier aesthetic moment, like it seems like a new moment is coming. I don't know. What do you think, Kat?
Gosh, I mean, at the point at which it's possible to leave your house and get care for your children again, I mean, who's to say whether, you know, former girl bosses or, you know, aspiring girl bosses won't come running out their doors and storm into boardrooms just, you know, for the sake of a change of scenery. I have absolutely no idea is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, we cannot recommend your book enough. This is Lee Stein's Self-Care.
Yeah. On sale June 30th.
Yes.
Whenever books are sold, you can pre-order it now from any number of fine establishments. Lee, do you have a favorite, a local or an indie that you want to plug before we...
Oh, I should mention that I am doing a virtual book tour. So if you go to my website, which is Lee Stein, LeighStein.com, I'm doing events at Books Are Magic in Brooklyn, at RJ Julia in Connecticut, and Skylight Books in LA. But of course, you can tune into any of these. And I'm also doing an event with you guys.
Yeah, which, how could we forget to mention that? Real, real on top of things. Neither one of us are girl bosses, clearly.
We don't have any venture capitalists knocking on our door. But
we just haven't
been able to choose which one. Our event is, sorry?
It's Wednesday, July 1st. And that the link to that is also on my website. And I'm sure if you follow any of us on Twitter, you can also find the link.
Yeah, we'll be online in conversation with both Lee and then Jesse Single and Katie Herzog of the Blocked and Reported podcast are also going to be joining us. It's going to be a hell of a party. And we look forward to them bringing all of their millions and millions of followers into the fold.
sure.
Thank you, Lee, for joining us. We're so excited about your book.
Yes. And thank you for writing the book. It's just yes. so great.
Thank you. Yeah,
you did. This was a brave and stunning act of, radical feminism or activism and self-care.
And self-care. Thank you.
All right. This has been Feminine Chaos. Thanks for joining us.